You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
With Chime Secure Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at chime.com/build.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Results may vary. See chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using Credible's simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying for your student loans. You could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. And for a limited time, my listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. That's Credible.com/kick. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In the 1968 election, nothing went according to script. LBJ was confident he'd dispatch with Nixon, the GOP frontrunner. Johnson's greatest fear and real nemesis was RFK. But Kennedy and his team, despite their loathing for the president, weren't prepared to challenge their own party's incumbent. Then, out of nowhere, Eugene McCarthy shocked everyone with his disloyalty and threw his hat in the ring to run against the president and the Vietnam War. A revolution seemed to be taking place, and LBJ, humiliated and bitter, began to look mortal. Then, RFK leapt in, LBJ dropped out, and all hell broke loose. Two assassinations and a week of bloody riots in Chicago around the Democratic Convention later, and the old Democratic Party was a smoldering ruin, and in the last triumph of old machine politics, Hubert Humphrey stood alone in the wreckage. Suddenly, Nixon was the frontrunner, having masterfully maintained a smooth facade behind which he feverishly held his party's right and left wings in the fold through a succession of ruthless maneuvers to see off George Romney, Nelson Rockefeller, Ronald Reagan, and the great outside threat to his new Southern strategy, the arch-segregationist George Wallace. Nixon then pulled off one of the greatest dirty tricks in American political history, an act that may well meet the statutory definition of treason, setting the tone for Watergate and all else that was to follow all the way through to today. For Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of MSNBC's The Last Word, the 1968 U.S. presidential election was his political awakening, and in the decades since, it has remained one of his deep abiding fascinations. For years, he's deployed one of America's shrewdest political minds to understanding its dynamics, not just because it's fascinating in itself, but because in it is contained the essence of what makes America different and how we got to where we are now. Lawrence O'Donnell writes about it in his newest book, Playing with Fire, The 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And today he joins me on the podcast to talk about the war that sunk LBJ's presidency and the wild election that followed. He discusses the bitter rivalry between Johnson and his own Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, Kennedy's gradual transformation from Vietnam hawk to peace candidate, and the assassination that threw the Democratic primary into chaos, leading up to the most violent political convention in U.S. history. He laments the indignities suffered by Senator Eugene McCarthy at the hands of the Democratic Party establishment, examines the difficult political position of the eventual Democratic nominee and Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, and analyzes the strategy behind the unlikely political comeback of Richard Nixon. Plus, we talk about Nixon's scandalous October surprise, the disturbingly familiar tone of the George Wallace campaign, and how 1968 set the stage for every presidential election to follow. coming up with Lawrence O'Donnell in just a moment. Lawrence O'Donnell is the host of The Last Word on MSNBC. Formerly an Emmy Award-winning executive producer and writer for The West Wing, O'Donnell also served as senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and chief of staff to the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works and the Senate Finance Committee. He's the author of Deadly Force, and his writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and elsewhere. Now Lawrence O'Donnell's written a new book called Playing with Fire, The 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence O'Donnell, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.
1968 was a pivotal year in American politics, the impact of which is still reverberating through every election over the past 50 years. Before we even get into the significance of that election, set the scene for us. Before any candidate even got in the race, what was the mood in America leading up to 68?
It was a terribly dark time. 1967, we saw over 11,000 American soldiers killed in Vietnam. And that's almost double, just as a scale for the audience, that's almost double the total amount of American soldiers who have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq over 16 years. So that was just for the year 1967. And then by 1968, we were going up. We went up to 16,589 American soldiers killed in Vietnam just in 1968. My cousin Johnny was one of them. And so we were one of those 16,589 American families who had a military funeral that year. And it was just another day in the life of America then. The anti-war protest movement had exploded in 1967. It had really taken off, and the first really gigantic peace protests in Washington occurred in 1967. And aiming toward 1968 and the hope that there would be a candidate who would emerge as the peace candidate, as an anti-war candidate to run for president and put the war on the ballot, because Lyndon Johnson was the incumbent president, Democratic president, running this war and escalating this war enormously every year, escalating it and committing more and more troops every year. Richard Nixon looked like the most likely Republican nominee on the other side, and he sounded pretty much the same as Lyndon Johnson on the war. There were some liberal Republicans. George Romney was a liberal Republican, Mitt Romney's father, and Nelson Rockefeller, liberal Republican, both of them Republican governors. And they were gearing up to run, and they were both beginning to lean in a bit of an anti-war direction. Romney much more so than Rockefeller, and so it became clear to some, but not to everyone, that the election was going to be about life and death. The election was going to be about the life and death of people we knew, not just some theoretical possible nuclear holocaust, but the life and death of people we knew in the jungles of Vietnam, because all young men 18 and over had to have draft cards in their pockets, and it was federal law that they must carry those draft cards with them at all times. And that draft card was the ticket to Vietnam, and that draft card was the most important, stimulus for the anti-war movement, that people were not going to risk their lives by 1968 for what was clearly an unwinnable war. And so it was a very, very dark time in the country. Mm-hmm. And I know there are people who believe, who were opposed to the Trump candidacy, who believe that the election of Donald Trump was a truly dark time. And if they're under 60, there's no question that it would qualify as the darkest feeling of that kind in their lifetimes. But it was much darker, much more dangerous in 1968.
Yeah, and you say that LBJ's guiding principle throughout it all was that he was determined not to be the first president to lose a war. Was it entirely about ego for him?
You know, that's not entirely about ego. That's about the presidency. It mm-hmm. sounds egotistical, but there's this thing that presidents are defending all the time, except for the current president, who doesn't have the slightest concept of what the job is about or any of the principles involved. But presidents have always been, prior to Trump, defending the presidency. Mm-hmm. And they believe that there is this thing called the presidency, which has honor, and it has a kind of dignity of its own. You know, you hear that phrase, respect for the office, you know, which has nothing to do with the person who's occupying mm-hmm. it. And that also informs the way you see former presidents behave. You see a former president like George H.W. Bush always being very friendly with former President Bill Clinton, even though Bill Clinton defeated him in a what for George H.W. Bush was a very bitter loss. They are in the aftermath of their presidencies. They unify as men, since they're all men, around a kind of defense of and unified public respect for the presidency. So it's a combination of egotism and this notion of the presidency that Johnson was defending in that concept of, I will not be the first president who loses a war. That thought consumed him. And because the war was hopeless and we were going to lose it, of course, that notion destroyed him, because he kept trying to find a way to not lose the war that we were going to lose. And the way to not lose the war was to commit more and more troops, mm-hmm. which meant more and more war dead and more people turning against the war and exercising their democratic right and voice to be against the war, voting for candidates for Congress, for the Senate, who were against the war. And so LBJ was in a quicksand there. And Richard Nixon adopted exactly the same attitude when he became president. He didn't want to be the first president to lose a war. Yeah. And when Nixon was running for president, he privately believed the war was unwinnable, absolutely unwinnable. Once he became president, he tried to pretend that it would be winnable, and there was some point that he could get to, that he could call a victory, or that he could at least use the phrase peace with honor. And so peace with honor meant, to the American ear, not surrender. That a surrender has no honor in the American ear at that point. And of course, Nixon couldn't ever get to that point, ever get to this peace with honor stage. And so ultimately, in the end, truly, everything that you saw there was simply a surrender. The United States of America simply surrendered in the guise of some kind of negotiated process. And as soon as the United States pulled out of Vietnam, South Vietnam collapsed, North Vietnam won the war, we lost.
The liberal wing of the Democrat Party was searching for a peace candidate to run against LBJ, which I don't think had ever really happened, that kind of an insurgent campaign against an incumbent, had it?
No, and we had never had an anti-war presidential candidacy ever. That anyone took seriously. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the pacifists had run for office, you know, not just third party candidates, but seventh and eighth party candidates on ballots in some states. But so this was the first anti-war candidacy that had real impact. This was Senator Eugene McCarthy, who decided to run for president in order to put the war on the ballot. And in order to do that as a Democrat, he had to run against his own Democratic president and enter the primaries against his own Democratic president. Now, when there's an incumbent president, that party doesn't even have primaries. In 2012, there were no primaries for Barack Obama. He got the nomination without ever running in primaries, and because no Democrat ran against him. That's normal. That's the way it's supposed to be. Gene McCarthy violated all of that, decided to go to New Hampshire, run against President Johnson, and he did very well. And he did so well that Bobby Kennedy jumped into the race after New Hampshire, and suddenly this insurgency against the Democratic establishment had two candidates in it, Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy. And the really interesting thing about Bobby Kennedy is he was the Democratic establishment. Here's an establishment guy running against the establishment. And so the confusion, to put it mildly, was wild, and kind of suddenly we're in this totally unpredictable zone, so unpredictable that Lyndon Johnson, after Bobby Kennedy got in, ultimately decided, I'm dropping out of the race. The candidate Lyndon Johnson feared more than any other was Bobby Kennedy. He feared losing to Bobby Kennedy. Richard Nixon feared losing to Bobby Kennedy. Gene McCarthy would not have run for president if Bobby Kennedy had got in first. Mm-hmm. Gene McCarthy wanted Bobby Kennedy to run for president as the peace candidate, but Bobby thought about it, turned it down. That left the opening for McCarthy, and McCarthy seized that moment.
Throughout this, I think one of the most sympathetic characters in this is Eugene McCarthy, because it seems to me that he's constantly treated as a stalking candidate. The only reason he runs is because Bobby says he's not going to. He seems to be kind of everyone's second choice, except for this band of very, very loyal McCarthyites, the Clean for Gene crowd. It seems like he's just always getting shortchanged and double-dealed throughout the 1968 election.
This was kind of an astonishing moment from a dramatist's perspective, because this really was what happens when a poet runs for president. Gene McCarthy was to be found in his Senate office more often than he should have been, reading poetry or writing poetry when he was supposed to be out there writing legislation and voting on it. He was this really deliberative intellectual who a lot of senators thought was aloof and wasn't interested in the daily hard work of the Senate. But he was interested in big ideas. No one denied that. And he was a genuine intellectual. No one denied that. And Gene McCarthy really was the last presidential candidate who believed that the best way to win the hearts and minds of voters was to flatter their intelligence. He would quote poets they've never heard of in the middle of speeches. He would go on and on like a college professor in a kind of detail, and he would never worry about, am I getting applause or cheers? He would never try to work, for that kind of crowd reaction. And his crowds really did love that, to the surprise of political operatives, because his crowds were all, at the beginning, college students themselves. They were accustomed to hearing professors they respected speak for 45 minutes without an applause line, so they had the attention span for this. But he was a truly unusual character. The book got a review in the Minneapolis newspaper, where Gene McCarthy was the senator from Minnesota. And that review declared Gene McCarthy to be the hero of this book. And I hadn't thought about it that way, and really? I certainly never said that as a sentence in the book, but I completely understand that interpretation of it. It's a very, very fair interpretation of it. He's also a wonderfully flawed character, and I say that from a dramatist's perspective. The kind of perfect guy is a very hard guy to write about because it's unidimensional, and there are, by the way, virtually none of those in politics. So and when you're in politics, you're always going to be writing about flawed human beings the flawed human being whose temperament is flawed. McCarthy's temperament was flawed. His his strategic thinking as a politician was flawed, but his nobility of purpose in this story is unquestionable. He set out to save lives. He set out to stop a war and save lives. And he actually did, in the end of the story, accomplish that. And the end of the story of the 1968 election was not election night 1968. It was really April 29th, 1975, when the last man to die for a mistake, as John Kerry put it, was killed in Vietnam. The last American soldier was killed in Vietnam on April 29th, 1975. And the United States pulled out of Vietnam immediately after that, pulled out permanently the last helicopter out of Vietnam. That would not have happened in 1975 if Gene McCarthy had not forced the war onto the ballot in 1968. If Gene McCarthy had waited until 1972, or Bobby Kennedy had waited until 1972 to mount the first presidential campaign against the war, it probably would have taken many more years than 1975 to end that war. And so Gene McCarthy's mission to save lives worked. It worked much more slowly than he wanted it to. It worked more slowly than everyone in America with a draft card wanted it to. But it did work. And so the nobility of his purpose is absolutely unquestionable. But you see in the book all sorts of flaky moments he has backstage in this story, and erratic behavior and unreliable behavior as an inside-the-game politician. And you can understand why so many of his fellow senators and politicians didn't like him, because he was so unlike them. And he disliked them. So, you know, Bobby Kennedy disliked Gene McCarthy a lot. Gene McCarthy disliked Bobby Kennedy even more than Bobby Kennedy disliked him.
Now, you said a moment ago that LBJ most feared Bobby Kennedy getting into the race. What had the relationship between LBJ and his attorney general been like prior to that election?
Absolutely terrible. And it was terrible. It was always terrible. You know, Lyndon Johnson was a power in the Senate, majority leader in the Senate, when Senator Jack Kennedy from Massachusetts was a relatively junior senator, junior member of the Senate. And even more junior than that was younger brother Bobby Kennedy, who was one of the staff lawyers working in the Senate in various jobs. Yeah. And Lyndon Johnson didn't like anything about Bobby Kennedy, even at the staff level in the Senate. He thought Jack Kennedy was okay, and he respected how Jack Kennedy had earned his position in the Senate through votes, but he had absolutely no respect for Bobby Kennedy getting his position to work in Washington, basically through his brother and his father. And so it started off very badly and then got much, much worse. And so, you know, because Lyndon Johnson is a force to be reckoned with in Democratic Party politics. And Jack Kennedy, when he is thinking about he's got the presidential nomination locked up, he has to think about a vice presidential nominee. He has to think about geographic advantages that different vice presidential candidates can bring him. He thinks about the South. He thinks about Texas. He thinks about Lyndon Johnson. And he offers it to Lyndon Johnson. This horrifies Bobby Kennedy, just horrifies him. And after Jack Kennedy has offered the vice presidency to Lyndon Johnson, Lyndon Johnson is smart enough and cagey enough not to say yes instantaneously, and thinks about it, says that he's going to think about it, but comes really close to saying yes to Jack Kennedy in the first discussion of it. Bobby gets wind of this and goes down to Lyndon Johnson's hotel suite, in the convention hotel, and tries to talk Johnson out of doing it. And it just tries to tell him how terrible a job, you know, you don't want to be vice president. Why would you want to lose all that power you have in the Senate? You know, it's because Bobby can't stand him and is going to be horrified to have him in the building and in the White House, in the executive office building, anywhere near the presidency. And Johnson is really irritated at this and really sees it as the spoiled little brat trying to do this to him. And of course, Johnson takes the vice presidency. And then after the assassination of President Kennedy, then Bobby Kennedy, who has become the attorney general, is now Lyndon Johnson's attorney general. And Lyndon Johnson is bossing him around. And Lyndon Johnson is showing virtually no personal sympathy to Bobby Kennedy about the loss of his brother. There's never that moment, you know, where Lyndon Johnson, you know, throws his arm around him and says, "I'm horribly sorry, you know, for what's happened to your brother." That never happens. And Johnson lives in fear of Bobby the whole time. He's looking at him as a potential political rival. You know, my own attorney general might turn on me and run against me for president. I mean, it was It was the most poisoned relationship that you may, that's possibly we've ever had in a presidential cabinet.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Lawrence O'Donnell when we come back in just a moment. Today's episode is sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using their simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying on your student loans. Plus, you could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away, you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Credible.com is completely free to use, and checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. Think about what you could do with $19,000. That's a new car or a down payment on a house. And for a limited time, our listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. Pay off your student loans faster or lower your monthly payment. Whatever works for you. Just go to Credible.com/kick. Today's episode is also sponsored by Grasshopper. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, you need to know about Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from Grasshopper's huge inventory of local, toll-free, or vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping for the holidays, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding to make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers an easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Be professional, responsive, and efficient with Grasshopper. Get your business phone number today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. I've always wondered how much of the enthusiasm was actually for Bobby Kennedy as opposed to trying to reclaim Camelot and frame him as the second coming of JFK.
You know, I don't think you can separate this mathematically and come up with a percentage. The answer is 100% of it. And yet Bobby Kennedy was his own person. Mm-hmm. Every moment Bobby Kennedy was on a stage as a politician, after the assassination, people were looking up at him adoringly with tears in their eyes because they were seeing his brother. But through Bobby, they had hopes of a restoration of a Kennedy presidency because Bobby was the one who could bring them that. And so they loved Bobby, and they loved him, the people who supported the Kennedys, as they were called in those days. It was considered, you know, there was no such thing in a certain way as Jack Kennedy. It was the Kennedys,
yeah.
And it meant this massive force of political power that was coming at you. And Bobby never invoked his brother, very, very rarely made a public reference to his assassinated brother, was always standing on the stage as his own man, as a politician. He ultimately quit the Johnson cabinet as attorney general to run for Senate in New York. He won that Senate seat, even though he got into the race at the very last minute. He won that New York Senate race, and he won it on his own. But he won it with the emotional momentum that the JFK assassination always had in Bobby Kennedy's life as a politician. And so he polled higher than he would have. He scored higher than he would have with voters without the incredible emotional aspect of the JFK assassination, which lasted for years in this country. Those of us who were alive, I was in elementary school at the time, and it was a thing that stayed with us and that we could feel very actively for 25 years afterwards.
And Bobby was, as you mentioned a moment ago, not an obvious choice to run as a peace candidate. He had supported the war. His brother helped get us into it. How did he evolve from Bobby the Hawk to Bobby the peace candidate?
He did it the way every single member of the Senate did it. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was passed when Lyndon Johnson was president, which he then used as a way to authorize vastly escalating the war and committing, you know, hundreds of thousands more troops and raging full-scale war. All of the senators, every senator voted for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, except for one, Wayne Morse. And Wayne Morse was defeated in his reelection campaign because he didn't vote for that. But Gene McCarthy voted for it. Every single person who became anti-war in the Senate by 1968 voted for the authorization. And so so Bobby was evolving. I see him now as evolving in a way that makes perfect sense in its time and its place in the 1960s. At the time when I was a kid, watching it from a distance as a high school kid in Boston, Bobby in 1968 appeared to me to be an opportunist. He appeared to me to be the guy who watches Gene McCarthy bravely go up to New Hampshire and battle Lyndon Johnson in that first primary that everyone thinks, Gene McCarthy's going to be left for dead in a snowbank in New Hampshire. And Gene McCarthy comes out with this fantastic, very, very strong second place showing, which he got over 40% of the vote. No one expected him to get over 4% of the vote when he started. And so from that perspective, when you know nothing about what was happening backstage, Bobby looks opportunistic. And the real fervent McCarthy supporters hated Bobby Kennedy for jumping into the race and therefore, in their mind, splitting the peace vote. Mm-hmm. The more I know about Gene McCarthy, the weaker he was as a candidate, the more I can see him backstage, the more I understand how unreliable and weak he was as a candidate to go through the full battle of a presidential campaign of seizing the nomination, beating Nixon. And Bobby is the opposite. Bobby is going to be the absolute best inside player at getting delegates that you don't get in the primary process because most states didn't have primaries. So most of your delegates you're going to have to persuade in basically a one-on-one process. Bobby was going to be much better at that than than Gene McCarthy ever could be. And he was going to be a much more dedicated, determined candidate who would never have a bad day. Gene McCarthy had plenty of bad days as a candidate, both in performance in the outside game on a stage and in the inside game in the back room. And Bobby thought about running for president long before Gene McCarthy did. He thought about it. He decided against it. He thought about it again. He decided against it. The people who were trying, the liberals in the party who were trying to find someone to run against Johnson on the war, wanted Bobby. Gene McCarthy wanted Bobby Kennedy to run for president so there would be an anti-war candidate. And then Bobby didn't. And Gene McCarthy really said he was going to do this only because Bobby wasn't doing it. That's what he wanted to happen. And so I actually don't see Bobby any longer as this opportunist. I understand his thought process. And remember, he had a unique burden. He was the only person who, when contemplating a run for president, had to worry that it might provoke a copycat assassin who wanted to get the next Kennedy on his way to the presidency. And it turned out that fear was justified.
Yeah. How did the Robert Kennedy assassination alter the Democratic race?
Well, it meant that Hubert Humphrey was pretty much guaranteed the nomination because
LBJ
dropped out, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, decides, I'm going to run. It was too late for Humphrey to enter any of the primaries. He didn't enter a single primary. He did not win one primary, and he won the nomination because you could win the nomination just by working the delegates in the convention hall in those days.
And this was the smoky back room days
of political conventions. You could ignore the primaries, and he did. I don't believe I believe Humphrey and Kennedy would have fought for that nomination right down to the wire, and I think they, I think the delegates would have decided Bobby is the stronger candidate to beat Nixon, and I believe they would have gone with Bobby. And I, and to take it further, I believe Bobby would have beaten Nixon because Hubert Humphrey was a terrible candidate. I don't mean a terrible man, but I mean as a candidate, as a performer on the stage, he was absolutely terrible. He was hamstrung by Johnson. There were all sorts of things he wanted to say that he couldn't say. So he sounded muddled and confused and weak all the time. And the, you know, the country had gotten used to seeing this incredibly glamorous and exciting campaign run by Bobby Kennedy that was ended by an assassin's bullet. And Hubert Humphrey was a terrible inheritor of all of that momentum. And still, in the end, Hubert Humphrey surged in October and closed to within 1% of Nixon. And Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey by less than 1% of the vote. And I have to believe that a dynamic Bobby Kennedy campaign would have done 1% better than Hubert Humphrey. That's all it had to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, Nixon was such an unlikely person to and come back and redeem
very
the Republican Party that year.
Nixon was also very unlikable. You know, he wasn't one of those guys who you could embrace and go, oh, I love this guy. It was, well, he's the guy. He's the Republican, so I'm with the Republican.
Yeah, I mean, he had been pretty much politically left for dead after he had lost the 1960 election to Kennedy, and then he couldn't even win governor of California. I mean, it's rare for a presidential candidate, a loser, to get a second chance. So how did he manage this comeback?
In 1960, Richard Nixon becomes the first vice president in history to lose a presidential election. First sitting vice president to lose a presidential election. Loses it to Jack Kennedy by less than 1% of the vote. 2 years later, he loses a campaign for governor of California, which everyone thought was an incredible, you know, self-demotion to go from vice president and a presidential contender to governor of California. Like, even if he got the job, it looked like a booby prize. And he manages to lose that. And then he does this very bitter press conference where he says, you know, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore, you know, which people remembered forever. And so that's the guy who's trying to rebuild and revive his political career by 1968 to run for president. And the reason that he can do it is that the Vietnam War is going so badly. And because Nixon has organized an incredibly effective corporate-run campaign.
Including Roger Ailes.
And he has brought in Roger Ailes, who was working in show business, producing a talk show in show business. Richard Nixon lures Roger Ailes out of show business, asks him to create TV ads for his 1968 campaign. Ailes does that. He does it brilliantly. He comes up with a form of TV advertising we hadn't seen before. It's been copied by everybody since. You know, Nixon put together every single element he needed. And the most important thing he needed was for the Vietnam War to be going badly so that any alternative to the Democrat, you know, might be better for the war. And Nixon committed the crime of colluding with a foreign power to do that. He secretly communicated with South Vietnam to not cooperate with Lyndon Johnson when Lyndon Johnson was organizing peace talks in Paris, and South Vietnam said to Johnson, yes, we will be there. We can be there in 3 days. And Nixon intervened through his secret communication channels, which the CIA discovered and the FBI discovered and reported to Johnson about. And Nixon's message to South Vietnam was, hang on, you know, do not agree to any terms. Don't go to the peace talks. I will get you a better deal. There's a private citizen violating the Logan Act, federal law, interfering with a foreign power. Not only that, but doing it in a time of war. And what he wants is for the foreign power to make sure the war continues. What he wants is to make sure more American soldiers are killed and that they're being killed on election day so Richard Nixon can win the election. When LBJ found out days before the election that Nixon was doing this, he called it treason when he saw the CIA reports, the FBI wiretaps, and saw everything that Nixon was up to. And it took us decades to prove this case, the revelation of CIA documents, FBI documents, and most recently, handwritten notes by Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, with Nixon telling Haldeman what to say in his next discussion with the people who were doing the secret communication with South Vietnam. And it's things like "hang on," those are in Haldeman's notes, and how can RN throw a monkey wrench into the peace talks? You know, they wanted to know what else does he have to do? You know, and it's really a stunning crime to read about how it was committed, how it was done. It's really the stuff out of a movie. And Nixon was obsessed for the rest of his life with covering that up. And that's part of why he started, you know, supporting, let's break into this office and see if they have this information. Part of the information he was afraid that the Democrats had was information on that collusion that he did to be elected president.
Well, I mean, Johnson knew about it, and that would have easily politically buried him in that election. How come Johnson kept quiet? How come he never condemned him publicly?
For the good of the country. That is a phrase that has...
It's an ironic
That's a phrase statement. That has covered up more things than anything else in government. A bunch of reasons. One, he wanted to do it. He threatened to do it. He told a Republican senator who he trusted to tell Nixon that he would expose him if he kept this up. And Nixon was not afraid of Johnson exposing him because I think Nixon guessed correctly that Johnson – not only will Johnson not expose him, but he will be advised not to expose him by his very own Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense.
Really?
That's exactly what they did. They said, we cannot expose this because it will reveal our intelligence sources. It will reveal that we have wiretaps on embassies in Washington. It will reveal much too much about our methodology. So that was one of the practical reasons. And those are very serious reasons because this involved CIA information. It involved FBI wiretaps that you would never want to make public. And you would have to in order to prove your case. And then if you didn't, if you said, I'm just going to assert it, I'm just going to let the Washington Post and the New York Times know it, the problem would be you wouldn't be believed, you know, because it's a political season. You're the Democratic president. You're saying condemning things about the Republican nominee. That's no surprise to anyone. It sounds like you're just trying to help the Democrat beat the Republican. That's what they said Johnson would sound like. And then there was this larger thing, which was these wise men in the White House wanted to protect the presidency and the image of the presidency. And they didn't want people to believe that someone who was capable of doing something like this could have been the vice president of the United States and could get this close to the presidency, whether he won or came in second.
Yeah, and one of the most tragic moments throughout the 1968 election was, of course, the Chicago Democratic Convention, which was arguably the darkest and most violent convention in American political history.
Yeah, there's nothing close.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely nothing close. How did it spiral so far out of control?
Well, the protest movement started planning what they were going to do at the Democrats' Chicago convention at the beginning of the year, before people were even voting in New Hampshire. Because they expected to be going to Chicago to protest the war president, Lyndon Johnson, who was going to be, renominated, obviously, to be the Democrats' candidate for president. And the president actually currently running the war was the worst enemy to them over, say, the possible Republican nominee at the Miami Beach convention that year, who might also have a very similar policy to Lyndon Johnson's, but Nixon or whoever that nominee was going to be would not actually be responsible for the war that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they expected to go to Chicago to protest. When they saw Bobby Kennedy jump into the race, a lot of the people who wanted to have the big protests in Chicago were actually disappointed because Jerry Rubin, one of the yippies, one of the leaders of the yippies, actually wrote a column in the Village Voice about how disappointed he was that that Bobby Kennedy was in the race, because he said, you know, we wanted to go to Chicago and prove to you that you live in a police state. And now what? You know, we go to Chicago and this Kennedy peace candidate gets the nomination. You know, this was before the assassination.
Yeah.
And so all of that was in motion. And then the Chicago convention, as it happened, was going to turn out to be the place where the war president, Lyndon Johnson, was going to see his chosen successor, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, nominated. And so it did have the quality of being the place to be if you wanted to protest the current Vietnam War policy. And that's what was driving all of those protests.
So then once the convention had happened and Humphrey was the candidate, who did the McCarthyites go to? Who did all those Clean for Gene people go to? Did they sit on their hands in the general election?
Gene McCarthy, go to Nixon? The way the convention was supposed to work, what everyone thought was going to happen, is that two names were going to be put in nomination, at least two, Hubert Humphrey and Gene McCarthy. And George McGovern had gotten so kind of disgusted and dissatisfied with the way Gene McCarthy was running his campaign that George McGovern had decided he was going to put his name in nomination as kind of an heir to the Bobby Kennedy campaign. So we were going to have these three names put in nomination. McGovern would have gotten the smallest amount of delegates. McCarthy had earned a very substantial amount of delegates through the primary process. And Humphrey had a massive amount of delegates, all from the inside game. So the most likely thing was these three names were going to be put in nomination. Humphrey would win on the first ballot. But there was an outside chance, you know, that there could be a McCarthy surge of some kind, but a very outside chance. Everyone concluded that was virtually impossible, and the most important person to conclude that was Eugene McCarthy. And he had an idea. And he communicated this to Stephen Smith, who was a very close Kennedy man, that he was willing to step aside and put all of his support behind Teddy Kennedy, who was not attending the convention. He was at his summer home in Hyannisport grieving his brother's assassination. He had no intention of going to the convention. And the word came to Teddy Kennedy that Gene McCarthy is willing to step aside for you. Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago, power broker, was very interested in the possible Kennedy draft because they were watching, the establishment guys were watching how bad a candidate Hubert Humphrey was out there on the campaign stages. He was just terrible, performing terribly. And so there was a real possibility for over 24 hours that they were going to present basically a draft Teddy movement. And the plan was for Gene McCarthy to go out there and have his name placed in nomination so that his supporters could have that tremendous satisfaction of getting to Chicago and seeing their candidate nominated. He would give an acceptance speech of placing the name in nomination. And he would then ask his supporters to support the name Teddy Kennedy, you know, Senator Ted Kennedy, when they actually call the roll for votes of delegates for what candidates you're voting for. That was the plan. Teddy Kennedy had one rule for this plan. If any of this plan leaks, if any of this becomes public before Gene McCarthy actually does it on the convention stage, then I will not allow it. This has to come as a pure draft. It has to be seen as a pure draft publicly. I will not participate if this is leaked as a plan ahead of time. And it's a crazy, out-of-control convention, so it was leaked. and CBS reported it, that there was something like this was brewing, and that was a very – it wasn't a completely accurate report, but it was more than 50% accurate. It was accurate enough for Teddy Kennedy to immediately drop out of the race, tell everybody in Chicago, nope, don't do this. Don't anyone dare put my name in nomination. He called up Hubert Humphrey and said, I'm with you. And I'll be supporting your candidacy.
And, of course, all the McCarthy people then went on in the general election to go around protesting Humphrey at every campaign stop.
Yes,
not
they
Nixon,
did.
Not Nixon, but Humphrey.
Yes, they did. And Humphrey had an incredibly difficult time with that. And as I say, you know, if he had one more day, Humphrey probably could have closed that 1% because he did finally separate from Johnson, not to the extent that McCarthy or Bobby Kennedy did, but he separated from Johnson's war policy in an identifiable way to voters. And as soon as he did that, he started surging up in the polls.
How much of a spoiler was George Wallace in 1968?
He wasn't the spoiler he wanted to be. He was looking like he was going to be the ultimate spoiler because it looked like he was going to sweep some southern states and thereby deprive anyone of a win in the Electoral College. It looked
like that was his strategy, right?
Yeah, it looked like he might actually make it impossible for Nixon or Humphrey to win the Electoral College. And that, according to the Constitution, would send the election into the House of Representatives, where the Democrats would decide it because they had the majority. And so what happened was he chose a vice presidential candidate who was terrible and completely crashed the Wallace campaign just over the vice presidential candidate. And his problem, as his vice presidential candidate, Curtis LeMay, was a former Air Force general in charge of bombing, and he talked very openly about the possible use of nuclear weapons. He sounded exactly like Donald Trump on the use of nuclear weapons. Well, if we have them, you know, we might have to use them sometimes. And he openly considered using nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Even Wallace supporters thought that was crazy, and they dropped Wallace instantly. Wallace collapsed in the polls. Wallace knew as he was listening to Curtis LeMay say this to reporters that his campaign was dying right before his eyes. And so Wallace ended up not being an actual factor in the outcome finally.
Did a lot of the language used by Wallace and LeMay sound familiar?
Oh, it's all Trumpian past language. Election? It's all Trumpian language. Wallace's campaign manager told me last year that when he listened to Donald Trump campaign, he was hearing George Wallace of 1968.
Wow.
It was all the same stuff.
Wow. What are some of the lasting impacts of this election now that we're about 50 years after that?
You know, one of the most important lasting effects of it is something that grows out of the first sentence of the book, where Richard Nixon meets Roger Ailes in the makeup chair at the Mike Douglas show. Richard Nixon's getting his makeup done to go on what Nixon thought of as one of these silly kind of show business talk shows of the day. It's 1967. It's the year before Nixon's going to formally announce his presidential campaign. He's gearing up for it. And Nixon complains to Ailes about the, why is a serious candidate like me on a silly show business talk show like this? This provokes Roger Ailes, who's the producer of that show, who's just meeting Richard Nixon for the first time, to light into Nixon for 15 minutes, telling him everything he's gotten wrong about television, everything he doesn't understand about television, and how television is the reason he lost the presidency in 1960, and he's not learning anything about it. And Nixon loves every word of this because no one talks to the former vice president like this. Everything Ailes is saying sounds correct to Nixon. It sounds like this is a real expert. And he asks Ailes to basically quit show business and come and join my campaign. And Ailes does that. He quits show business. He joins the Nixon presidential campaign. He creates TV ads that are better than anyone's ever seen in campaign advertising at that point. He helps Nixon get elected. He helps Ronald Reagan get elected. He stays as a political media guy for presidential campaigns, helps George H.W. Bush get elected. He never goes back to show business. Rupert Murdoch hires him in 1996 to create Fox News as Republican TV, which he does, and he creates a flawless platform for Republican candidates called Fox News, and that is exactly the platform that carried Donald Trump to the presidency. And I don't believe there was anyone in Republican politics who could have created Fox News into a stronger and better supporter of Republican candidates than Roger Ailes' Fox News. And I believe that if Richard Nixon didn't like what Roger Ailes was telling him in that makeup chair and did not lure Roger Ailes into politics, we would have a different president today.
Well, before we go, real quickly, there are rumors of people like John Kasich challenging Trump in 2020. Based on what happened in 68, what kind of advice would you give to any Republican insurgent?
Well, you know, I think they're all looking at that Gene McCarthy path of that insurgency on the edge of your party. Pat Buchanan did it in 1992 in the Republican Party. He did it against George H.W.
Right.
Bush. He
That's right.
ran on the right side of the party. If Kasich does it, it'll be something we've never seen before. He will be running on the moderate side of the candidate instead of on the extreme edge. So on the Democratic Party, we've seen it with Bernie Sanders. We've seen it with Gene McCarthy, that running to the left of the establishment. On the Republican side, we've seen running to the right of the establishment. And Buchanan, of course, did not win the nomination, but he really softened up George H.W. Bush in 1992 so that Bill Clinton could beat him. I expect us to see Kasich or someone like that run to the left of the Republican, and that's going to be a new route that we haven't seen
before. Does that seem like a very likely path to winning a nomination?
We're going to find out because this is the most unpopular president in the history of polling, and so we're going to find out.
Well, again, the book is called Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence O'Donnell, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Lawrence O'Donnell for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics, on Amazon, or download the audio version at audible.com. Watch The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell every weeknight at 10 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC, and follow him on Twitter @@Lawrence. Today's episode was sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using Credible.com's simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying on your student loans. You could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. And for a limited time, my listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. That's Credible.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickassNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.